inviting me and for showing up on a beautiful morning. So I'm going to talk today, I'm going to turn this a bit, about sort of the second half. Whoops. Am I coming out of the mic? Okay. About this sort of big topic that lots of people think is important, but we don't necessarily have a way into it, civil discourse and moral community. And this is part two about what I'm calling moral faith, and I'll explain in a bit what I mean by that. I'm just going to rearrange things a bit here. So if you, I'm not going to assume that either that everybody was here last week or that everybody remembers, even if you were here last week. I know what happens to my memory from week to week. But so the general picture that I've been presenting over these 2 weeks is a question about sort of civil discourse. You know, what does it mean to interact with other people in a way that is not just, and I'm going to say a bit more, not just sort of civil, but maybe even a little bit more than that. But what is it that we're talking about, and why is it so important? I think most of us think it's important, but we don't necessarily know why. So one reason why we might think, or argument, is that there are some things or some attitudes that are contrary to civil discourse or that make it really difficult. And last time I talked a lot about contempt and how contempt inhibits our civil conversations. And today I'm going to talk about sort of the flip side of that, what I'm going to call having faith in people, which I'm going to call moral faith for reasons that I'll explain. And I'll explain what it is that I have in mind by that. So my big picture is a claim that in order to have civil discourse, right, we have to avoid contempt and we have to sort of try to cultivate this attitude that I'm calling moral faith in other people. So just a quick, oops, hold on, I am, there we go, okay. The mirroring is half second behind. Just a quick overview. What I had said last time, what I see is the moral problem with contempt has to do with two different things that contempt does to our communities. So I had a circle representing the moral community here. And if we think about these stick figures as members of our community, contempt, I suggest, has a couple of things. One, contempt expresses an attitude toward another person that they don't really belong in the moral, in the community, that they're not, they don't have the sort of the worth or the value that would enable them to be a member of this community. And I suggested that contempt, when it's expressed towards someone, is often intended to get what we might call uptake from other people. So when I express contempt towards someone, especially if I do it in a public setting, I'm sort of often hoping that other people will take on my attitude as well. This is going to be important to what I say today, so I wanted to stress that. So contempt, I suggest, expresses an attitude towards somebody else that I think is always a problem because it suggests that the person themselves doesn't belong in the moral community. And it can also have a further effect, which is that it can sometimes, especially if the person who's expressing the contempt wields a lot of social power, can have the effect of pushing someone outside the community. This is particularly possible when the person who's exercising power here directs their contempt towards someone who is already vulnerable in some way to marginalization or dehumanization. So within this circle, even though we're all sort of in important, really important sense equal within the circle, social power relationships can affect people's capacity to sort of maintain their standing and have that standing respected. And so my other suggestion was, besides expressing an attitude, that contempt, when it's exercised by someone who is powerful and directed at someone who is vulnerable, can marginalize someone in a way that effectively prevents them from acting as full members of the moral community. And so I gave as an example one that is depressingly familiar, but a tendency for people to marginalize people who, say, have disabilities and push people with disabilities outside of the sphere of interaction, and in doing so, prevent people with disabilities from inhabiting, so say, or sort of occupying their role in this moral community. So contempt, I suggest, is a very destructive attitude. One way of saying what contempt does, is that contempt blocks the possibility of what we might call relationship. And when I mean relationship here, I mean the sense of relationship that I think is familiar to many people, particularly within religious communities, not like a relationship, although, of course, being in relationship with people can mean a relationship. But being in relationship with people is to see them as either actual or potential members of your community. So if we think about, what the function of a church community is that anyone who walks through those doors, right, who sort of asks to be part of it, then we welcome them into a community. That's what a church is to be sort of open to the possibility of relationships with people, relationship, to be in relationship. And contempt, I suggest, blocks that possibility, because what it does is suggest to the other person or give up the attitude that you don't belong, you're not worthy of relationship, you're not sort of part of this community. Now, this, I think, helps us understand what is particularly maybe troubling or should be troubling about punishments like solitary confinement. So there's, as you may know, lots of controversy about this as a form of punishment. Now, as someone who is by nature an introvert, and particularly when my kids were little, there was often nothing I thought that sort of seemed more appealing than being sort of by myself in a room for a long period of time with a novel and some tea. But we know that what we think of solitary confinement, right? What solitary confinement does as a form of punishment is basically deny the prisoner any kind of connection, any kind of relationship with people. And that's one of the compelling reasons for thinking that it's a particularly inhumane form of punishment is precisely that. That if the goal of solitary confinement is to isolate someone from community with anyone at all, right, then it has the effect of dehumanizing the person because they're not able to sort of engage in this fundamentally human activity of being in relationship with other people. So contempt, and in fact, Immanuel Kant, who I talked about last week, was deeply worried, actually, about a lot of forms of judicial punishment that he thought were dehumanizing. He was writing in the 18th century, so he was more concerned with things like drawing and quartering. But the kinds of conversations that we have in our culture about what things like capital punishment or solitary confinement or other ways in which we engage with people and we enact punishment, the debates are the same. We think about the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. Part of what makes punishment cruel and unusual is not just that it causes tremendous physical pain, that is a problem, but also this idea that the blocking the possibility of relationship with anyone is at odds with sort of being human. Now, one of the challenges with this, and this came up some last time, is that we often think, and I suggested, listen, that we should be often angry at people with whom we are in relationship. That this notion of relationship should be one, I think, that can accommodate rightful anger and even outrage at people who are behaving badly. And I think this is important, so I'm going to come back to this, because the sense in which I think contempt is a problem, blocking the possibility of relationship, I want to still enable it to be possible for people to respond in appropriate ways to the others who are not holding up their end of the bargain, for instance. So, taking out in the extreme cases, imagine, someone who's in an abusive relationship and takes out a restraining order against someone. I want that to be compatible with my sense of relationship as well. So I'm going to come back to this at the end. Okay, so contempt blocks the possibility of relationship. Now, when I'm talking about this concept of being in relationship, and I had that circle which had all those stick figures in it, and I said that contempt is an attitude that should not be present in that community. Instead, because it blocks the possibility of relationship, so then that naturally leads to the question, what does it mean to be in relationship with other people? What does it look like, and what does it require of us? So what does that really mean? We say it a lot, or we think about it a lot, but what does it look like? In particular, what does it look like in context where we disagree with people and disagree with people on things that are really important to us? This is one of the things that threatens civil discourse in our communities, is that we disagree, but we disagree about stuff that we think really matters, things on which we think it's important to take a stand. And civil discourse, of course, becomes more and more difficult the more challenging and the more emotionally charged the issues become. I'm going to suggest that what being in relationship with other people requires of us, especially in discussions and debates about things that are very, very challenging because they strike very deeply at the hearts of what people care about and what matters to them, that what we need is this attitude that I'm calling moral faith. So, what is this? In explaining what I mean by moral faith, I want to sort of go backwards into it. I'll come up with an account of what I mean in a bit. But I want to start with something a little bit different. So we say things like this fairly often. Sometimes we say it about ourselves, but it's something that we will sometimes say about someone else, right? Maybe to excuse their behavior to ourselves or to other people. But it's an expression that we're familiar with when someone is just not themselves. And there could be lots of reasons for this. They could be suffering from mental illness. They could be in a lot of pain. They could be suffering from grief. There's a lot of things that might make somebody not themselves today. And it's a peculiar expression if we think about it, right? Because what else could you be but yourself? But there's what this says, right, or what it's getting at, is the idea that we can distinguish between sort of the self that shows up on a given day or that's expressed and what we might describe as the person's sort of true or real self, the self that's underneath, and often the self that we know is there, because if we live with the person or we're close to the person, we know that this isn't how they always are. Right? There's the self they really are, and then there's the self that is affected by whatever is going on. And so when we say, well, this person is not himself today, the self that we mean here usually is kind of the true self. Like, that's the self that he's not today. Right? And the one that he is today is somehow different from or separate from the self that we sort of know is, I don't want to say underneath exactly. Now, of course, we also know this expression can be taken too far, right? Sometimes people will say this as a way of sort of getting out of behavior. And also, I mean, if that's how the person is every day, we might think, well, he is himself today. Unfortunately, he is himself today, depending on how we're thinking about this. But I want to sort of pull into this idea that there is sometimes we have this sense of a kind of an underlying self that we think of as being sort of the real self or the true self or the deeper self. This idea, I think, is important to what I'm calling moral faith. Now, there's a philosopher named Hilda Lindemann who's written a lot of interesting work about a concept of what she calls sort of holding people into an identity. And her concept of holding is very much like when we sort of, in some ways, we're on a stage and we're sort of acting. We hold someone into an identity or hold someone into a role that they're playing. So if we're interacting with someone as a character and we're trying to interact with them, the way in which they can sort of inhabit that character on stage is by other people treating them as if they're that character, interacting with them that way. So I have nieces who, when they were very small, wanted to be cats all the time. So you had to interact with them as cats, right? And so you would sort of help them keep up the pretense that they were cats by kittens, usually by sort of interacting with them as kittens. This is how this is how this works. This notion of holding a person into a self or identity, I think, is important because I think it's something that we do all the time, and it's something that we can do, as I'll say in a minute, in better or worse ways. But the idea of holding a person into an identity, I think, comes out pretty clearly. When we think about something like interacting with people with, say, Alzheimer's disease or severe forms of dementia, something that many people, probably most people, are familiar with. So one of the things that, of course, is most devastating for caregivers and others of people with Alzheimer's is that the person becomes less and less capable of inhabiting the identity that they've always had. I don't mean to oversimplify the challenges, but one of the things that we sort of standardly do, it seems right, is continue to interact with the person and inhabiting that role. So even if the person forgets or no longer is able to act like somebody's parent or spouse because they no longer can think of themselves in that role, or they don't know they have that role, but it's possible for us, and we do this all the time, to still interact with them as if they're in that role. And this is a way in which we can hold people into an identity, even if they can no longer occupy that identity or take it on. So it's possible to sort of keep somebody in their identity, for instance, as your mother, even if she is no longer in a position to remember that she is your mother or to interact in that relationship. That it's possible to continue to hold that person in that identity, or as we might say, that self, through what we do, how we interact with a person. And so this can be applied in a lot of different contexts. It's also really important, just in general really important, if we think about care for people who are significantly disabled, that holding people into an identity, into a kind of human identity, happens in part by the way that we interact with people. Do we continue to talk to people, address them, try to sort of put, you know, dress them or you know, do somebody's makeup or hair in the way that they would want them to be? There's a lot of things that we do that help that person sort of occupy that social role. So this notion of holding a person into identity, I think, is going to be very important to what I mean by moral faith. Because what I think that moral faith is an attitude. That moral faith, as I'm talking about it, is something that is directed not at what the person is like today, but at what we might call sort of their true moral self or their deeper moral self. That moral faith is going to be a way of recognizing or acknowledging a person's deeper, truer moral self, even in circumstances where they aren't sort of living up to or occupying that role themselves. And in moral faith, when we have a community that is characterized by what I'm calling moral faith, what we have is a community in which we engage in a kind of reciprocal holding of each other into those deeper, truer moral selves, even in circumstances where we can't sort of live up to those selves. And so I use the stage metaphor. I do that not because I want to diminish this at all. I just think actually dramatic metaphors are interesting this way. But if we think about what makes a successful dramatic performance, it's when the people on stage or putting on are engaged in a kind of reciprocal practice of holding each other into those roles. When people forget lines or move to the wrong spot, there's a lot of engaging so that we can sort of keep up the production, keep up the play. It's a parallel, I think, to what I'm suggesting here, that moral faith is an active process. It's going to involve, as I'll say in a minute, some things about our beliefs and our attitudes, but it's an active process in which we shape our interactions so that those interactions enable us to kind of occupy ourselves or identities as our sort of what I'll call our true or deeper moral selves. So last time I used a version of this picture, a kind of relationship between sort of our actual selves, the really flawed ones, the cranky ones who haven't had coffee yet and who are annoyed by traffic and all the ones that we standardly are, and we might say sort of the self that we're capable of being here. And although we're often here in the land of the actual flawed self, it is important, I think, for all of us to sort of remember, and not just remember in the sort of the back of our heads, but in a way that's sort of palpable, this, the selves that all of us are capable of being. And this, I think, has an effect on our social interactions, because what we have to do, I think, is shape our social interactions with people in ways that reflect sort of both the fact that we are very flawed, but we're capable of more. We're capable of being better than we are. And in order to sort of keep this in mind, keep this at the forefront, we have to alter or set up our social interactions or engage with them in ways that hold us into these selves that we're capable of being, even when we're not actually living up to them. And this is where moral faith comes in. I'm still on the Wi-Fi. Okay. I have a delay. There we go. Okay. Yeah. So social interactions, I'm going to suggest, create something that I'm going to call normative space. So by normative space, I mean space in which people can do or are unable to do certain kinds of actions or responses. Normative space is, I think, importantly related to physical space. So because I spend some of my time teaching in classrooms, I'm cognizant of the ways in which physical space in my classroom is set up and how those things are interacting. So as we all know, nobody ever sits in the front row, right, for lots of reasons, even in church, in classrooms, nobody sits in the front row. And there's also interesting, even thinking about in church, where people sit, people always sit in the same place or sit on the ends of pews. And we all have our sort of sense of physical space and where we feel comfortable in a room, and for whatever reason, nobody ever feels comfortable in the front row. And there's ways in which we know that this can foster or hinder interactions. So in a classroom, and especially at a place like Georgetown, where we have a pretty big gap, actually, we're thinking about campus communities for many campuses, and in ours, I think one of the biggest things we have is a socioeconomic gap, because we have students from very different backgrounds. And there's focus on a lot of college campuses like Georgetown about what's often called social capital, and the ability of people to feel like they can move through space competently and know what they should do and how they should do it and all of this. And this is something that many people take for granted if they already have it, but they don't see how it enables them to navigate space well and do the things that they would need to do. And so we have actually a great program now that's been building up in the last few years as we attend to it, that focuses on actually mostly first-generation college students and helping first-generation college students not just meet sometimes financial needs that people wouldn't be aware of, but also help them understand a lot of things that others may take for granted. How do you ask for a letter of recommendation? You know, how do you sort of participate in this, things that people wouldn't know? Because we recognize that someone's capacity to sort of really occupy that role of a student may depend on what their background is and what they feel like their capabilities are. So creating a good normative space, a space where people can sort of really inhabit whatever role that they're in, requires attentiveness to physical space considerations. I find it interesting, there's research that shows that people feel their comfort level with how close people stand to each other varies quite a bit by culture. This is very interesting. So we're all familiar with that sense of feeling like people are too close. And if you notice, I'm sure everybody does, if you're on an airplane or you're in an elevator, on an elevator or on a crowded metro, that people's behavior, the more crowded it becomes, people's behavior changes, right? We do things like on elevators. Actually, there's studies on elevators. It's fascinating. There's a pattern that you probably all follow without knowing. The people actually go stand in elevators in a very specific order, like where they go. Like first you get the corners, and everybody, as we know, you kind of look up. Nobody makes eye contact in elevators. That would be strange. You have to face the doors. You look up at the numbers. You lower your voice. There's conventions that we do in elevators, and it's very interesting. One explanation for this, I think, this is not a psychologist because I'm not a psychologist, is thinking about, well, in elevators, in these crowded conditions with strangers, one of the things we have to do is let other people know that we sort of respect their space. And so this is why, like, you don't make eye contact with the person sitting next to you normally because you're already in this really close quarters, and eye contact creates intimacy, and the last thing anybody needs in coach is more intimacy with the person sitting next to them. There's plenty of that already. And so we alter our behaviors in ways to sort of account for the fact that we're often very uncomfortable being in such close physical quarters with strangers. And so we change our behaviors to sort of express to other people, right, that even though we're sitting very close to each other, I still respect your space and you and your ability to move and, you know, plug in your devices and all these things. So the physical space that we're in affects our ability to do certain kinds of things. And we have the capacity to alter our physical space. But the kind of space that interests me here when I'm talking about normative space is mostly about the ways in which we allow people to sort of occupy those roles. So in the classroom setting, again, you know, what students I call on, right, or if I notice, right, the hand that shoots up. So one thing that's very interesting in classroom settings is that if you ask a question and you wait, you're supposed to wait 10 seconds. It feels like forever when you're standing there, but if you count. But by the second, like, 7 or 8, more hands start to go up because there's a lot of people who will just shoot their hand right up, but there's also a lot of people who have something to say but who won't put their hand up within the first 4 to 5 seconds. And so if you just wait, you get a different sort of selection of people, sort of different people. And so one thing that maybe the more introverted or the less confident students need in order to sort of participate in that discussion is just flat out more time before I call on the person who's answering the question. So normative space is sort of the space that we sort of allow or take from people that enables them to inhabit those roles well. And so it does relate to physical space, but it's not just about that, because it's also about what we sort of accept or disallow from other people, as we might say, acceptable social moves. So I want to talk about this phrase for a minute. So often people will say this as a way of sort of scaling back on something that they've said, right? So somebody says something that is perhaps insulting or at least a bit rude, right? And sometimes then if the person expresses unhappiness or expresses a reaction, they'll say, well, I was only joking. Now, this happens a lot, right? And sometimes it's true, sometimes it's not true. But what I want us to think about is the way in which this shapes then what can happen next. So if we think of this, I don't want to turn this into like a chess match or something, but if we think about playing games, what someone does affects what other people can then do afterwards. And so if someone says, hey, that was insulting what you just said, or that was somehow like or derogatory, and then the other person says, I was only joking, what they have done then is change the normative space. Because then the other person is in a position of having to say, no, you weren't joking, or it wasn't funny. But it suggests that they then have to accept it as a joke, as not serious. And also that if they don't do that, then they're someone who can't take a joke. Right? So we're familiar with this as well. So in a social interaction, if this person says something that's insulting to this person, and this person calls them out on it, and then this person says, I was only joking, this is constraining the options for this person. Because they have to accept the remark as a joke in that social context, or else engage in a much more confrontational relationship with that person. So sometimes saying, oh, I was just joking, is a way of kind of deflecting responsibility for what you just said. But it does it in a way that alters the normative space. Because by saying, hey, I was only joking, that means that other people are then having to take what I said as a joke. Right? So that sort of blocks certain kinds of responses from them. Now, this doesn't always work, right? Because sometimes people will say, well, even if you were joking, because there are things, even when it is a joke, it's still not appropriate or it's still not funny. So saying I was only joking isn't like a way of getting, you know, your get-out-of-jail-free card by any stretch. But I'm using this as an example because I think it clarifies what I mean by sort of altering the normative space. If I say my remark is a joke, then I'm sort of obligating other people to treat what I said not very seriously. It can go the other direction, too. So often, I mean, now as those of us with teens and tweens are constantly saying, everything you put into that phone is public, like it's as if you're putting it on a billboard. They know that in some ways better than we do. But we live in a culture in which people's words are recorded for posterity, and we tend to know exactly what everybody said. And I don't think there is anyone who ever manages to say exactly what they mean at all times, right? So it's easy for us to say things that really don't reflect what we mean. And sometimes what we say doesn't come out well or comes out not as we intended. There are ways in which we can sort of dodge responsibility for that, as some of the joking remarks say. But one thing that we're often hoping for is that people will accept it when we say, that isn't really what I meant to say, or I didn't mean for it to come across that way, because we're sincere and we recognize that even though it did come across that way, we didn't mean it to be that. Right? And there are ways in which other people can give us space to make those mistakes. And one of the ways in which we give people room to make mistakes is to sort of start our responses by things like, maybe I misheard you, or maybe I didn't understand what you were saying, or perhaps this is what you meant to say. So if someone says something that says, let's just say, very ever so slightly racist, right? Someone might respond by saying, well, it sounded that way, but you probably didn't mean it that way. Maybe this is what you meant. Now, when we do this for people or have other people do it for us, what we're doing then is sort of creating space for them to then step up and be like, you're right, I didn't mean to say that. This is what I meant to say. That when we offer the possibility of a different meaning or a different interpretation, we allow somebody to occupy a different normative space. So they've said something that they shouldn't have said. Right? We say, oh, I probably misunderstood you, right? And then we give a better version of what they've said. It can be a way of doing someone a favor because it enables them to be like, yes, this is what I meant. This is what I wanted to say. And so it enables them to occupy a different role in that space. So Kant, who I talked about, Immanuel Kant, who I talked about last week, said that we have a duty to do what he calls this the veil of philanthropy or the veil of charity over the flaws of other people. And he's talking about this mostly in the context of spreading nasty gossip, which he thinks we have a tendency to do because we enjoy it and it feeds our self-conceit. Because he says instead what we should be doing on the surface is to do this throwing like this veil of charity, right? That there's a lot that we don't know about other people's motives and what they meant, and that the practice of not immediately jumping to the worst possible conclusion, they meant this, right? Clearly, or they said this, they must be a terrible person. That might be true, but that jumping to that conclusion, as we're prone to do, right, is sort of the opposite of what I'm describing as moral faith, because it's closing down their normative space. It's saying, oh, they said that, they must be a racist. They might be a racist. Or they might be someone who said something that they didn't exactly mean. And so the veil of charity is aimed at sort of throwing, saying, well, maybe this isn't what they meant. Maybe they meant to say something else. Maybe this is what they meant. And by tossing that out as a possibility, we create space for the other person then to live up to that role. Now, what does that living up to that role consist in? Well, it doesn't necessarily mean ignoring what they said. It might give them space to apologize, to do a lot of different things. But it's sort of offering a way for the other person, another avenue, for the person to take a different route. So the "I was only joking" remark sort of closes out the possibilities for other people, because we're now saying, oh, this is just joking, so you're not allowed to be insulted. But there's things like, I probably misunderstood you, or, you probably didn't mean it to come out that way, does something different. It opens up space and allows people a pathway toward sort of occupying that better self. And that's what I have in mind when I'm talking about holding people into their moral self. That what we do when we say things like, you probably didn't mean it to come out that way, we're sort of holding out this identity of a person who wouldn't have said such a thing on purpose. We're holding that out and saying, here's your better self. Occupy. Be that better self. Giving them a space in a social interaction to be that self. So moral faith, as I'm thinking of it, requires three things. One is a belief that others are worthy of relationship. So this is the part that's incompatible with contempt. Contempt expresses the idea that somebody is not worthy of relationship. Moral faith is a belief, sometimes against evidence, that everybody is worthy of relationship, that they deserve a chance of relationship. Second part of it, believing that others are capable of relationship. This is sometimes really hard. I think this is, both of these are actually, as I see them, pretty things to which, I think certainly Christians and people in lots of religious traditions think of themselves as being committed to doing. In fact, this is necessary to make sense of a lot of things about our views about sort of what people are and what they're capable of and sort of who they are. So we have to believe that others are worthy of relationship, and we have to believe that they're capable of relationship, even if they're not doing it right now. And the last bit, and the one that I've been focusing on, that moral faith is not just about having these beliefs about people, it's also about acting on those beliefs, and acting on those beliefs in social interactions, that we are holding people into relationship, the relationships that they can occupy, by holding them into their true moral selves. Now, at the beginning, I suggested that One of the things, and often when I talk about contempt, as I often do, people are like, but there's terrible people in the world. There's people who deserve contempt, right, who do terrible things. What are we just going to say? Oh, they probably didn't mean that. You know, when you've got people marching through the streets of Charlottesville, as we were talking about, with, you know, Nazi flag and, you know, and Confederate flags, you're thinking, where are their moral selves? They're not really showing up here. I do think that this holding people into their moral selves needs to be compatible with outrage. And in fact, I think outrage is actually a way of holding people into their moral selves. That when we are outraged at white supremacists marching through streets, right, we are expressing our belief that people are capable of more. It is the contempt, as I said, sort of goes to the belief that no, like they just can't, we just have to sort of brush, you know, so I need to brush them aside, but that the outrage is a way of holding them accountable for not doing what we know they could do, which is come to see what's wrong with their worldview. And so I think outrage is compatible with holding people into their moral selves. Because sometimes, you probably didn't mean that, isn't the right response, because sometimes the person absolutely did mean it. And so when you say, what you just said, right, was deeply racist, sexist, whatever, you know, and you say this to someone in a context where you know perfectly well that they meant it, or there's no way that someone, or it's part of a pattern, or there's no way that someone could have said that, sort of misspeaking, that saying that is not okay, that is unacceptable, that is dehumanizing, is a way of holding the person into their moral self, their moral identity, in a more confrontational way, for sure, than the other ones. But I think that this is fully, outrage is fully compatible with civil discourse. I think we can be mad at people, outraged by people. Civility is not just about being pleasant and nice, although that should no doubt be our default mode in lots of circumstances where it's not. But it doesn't require that we're always just sort of like, you know, papering over conflicts, right? Civility requires that we treat people, engage with people, and ourselves, because it requires humility on our parts, as if we could all be doing better than we are. And that can involve being exceptionally mad. As, for instance, this is a Caravaggio. It's kind of hard to see there, too, but a Caravaggio painting of Jesus overturning the tables of the money changers in the temple, right? So this is a fascinating account, right? Because it may not seem like the Jesus, you know, it could just be fully human Jesus, you know, having a bad day, right? Or not being himself, we might say. But probably not. Probably that's not the best way of thinking about this. But I think this is a nice example of outrage. And okay, maybe that turning the tables was necessary, right? But it's compatible with thinking that you could be doing better, that what you're doing is outrageous, incompatible with this. And sometimes anger and outrage and overturning tables might well be what we need to do. Shouldn't be the go-to method, because it tends not to be particularly effective. All it does, it may do. Actually, who knows what happened to the money changers after that or what their attitudes were. But we also often know from our own experiences that anger and outrage often just make people shut down, right? It doesn't help them occupy that space. What often does help people occupy their space is this kind of, I know you could do better, right? And not just I know you could do better, but giving people space to be better, because in part because that helps them sort of maintain their self-respect in that context. So I'm not suggesting this is always the best response. I think we go for this way too often in our conversations, that it's in part going back to last week because it's fun. Anger and outrage are in some ways more fun. They could be, or at least contempt can sometimes be. By fun, I mean that it feeds our own natural sense of superiority. And so the anger and outrage have to come from the right place. It can't come from I'm outraged because I would never do such a thing, because there's ways in which that outrage can express my own sense of superiority. It can't be that. The outrage, if it's going to be compatible with moral faith, has to be compatible with this belief. And I would suggest further than that it has to be in some ways compatible for rooting for people, in a sense that you can root for people, you can want them to do well. So I think of this, until the Cubs won the World Series, I often think of this as like rooting for the Cubs, like even if it's a losing team, like you should still, it could be a Cubs fan, it doesn't work anymore. You can pick a different formerly losing team, that we have to want people to occupy those selves too. And that requires not sort of taking pleasure when they fail. That we have to believe that they're capable of it. We have to hold them into that. And we should want them to occupy that self. And we should be glad when they do, as opposed to sort of annoyed. So I've suggested so far that moral faith is how we hold each other into relationship, into our truer moral selves, particularly in challenging circumstances. It's easy when we agree with people. It's much harder when we don't, when we're trying to sort of work through difficult or complicated issues. It's hard, you know, and I think certainly we see this too. I don't know. I mean, maybe you say it's always been this way. I don't know. Probably our country has been equally divided in other parts. I mean, the Civil War, you know, but we're in a period of deep division and polarization in our culture. Not entirely around politics, but certainly that's a big part of it. And so I think it makes moral faith more challenging than it has been in other circumstances. And the more challenging the circumstances, the more moral faith we need. I've suggested over the past couple of weeks that contempt destroys relationship, that sense of community, that it's incompatible with it, and that moral faith sustains it. But moral faith is hard work. Not just to maintain the belief that people are capable of more, but acting on that belief and sort of living it out and creating the space for people to do better than they are. Okay.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because shame, I think, is really interesting. I mean, you're right. I think shame has to be used very judiciously, because I think what we want is for people to feel ashamed, right, when they've acted badly, or not to be shameless. And so then there's an interesting question about whether shaming people is the way to do it. I'm not so sure about that. And I think it's particularly complicated when there are power relationships at stake, which going back to the thing about contempt. So I think everybody knows that when you're in a position to sort of shape somebody's self-conception or their belief about themselves, then you have to wield that very, very carefully, right? So parents, teachers, anyone who is in a position, right, both of power over the person, and power in a way that only makes the person think about themselves differently and also other people think about the person differently, has to think really hard about how to use that power. So one difference might be the public versus the private. Like, sort of shaming someone in front of others is sometimes effective, but also potentially more damaging. And then the shame, or sort of how do you create a version of shame? I mean, it's the kind of thing like, you know, I'm disappointed in you. You know, does that work? Well, only if the person cares about whether you're disappointed in them, right? And so some might be, I don't have a lot of, I mean, I find that so often it's so hard to know what's going on underneath the surface, that a student's bravado or something like that could be hiding something else, that I'm always like, what do I know enough about this student to think that what I'm doing is this? But I think it's possible either to be outraged or to, you know, to sort of set up the burden on them. You know, like, look, you know, you didn't turn in your paper on time, right? This is what I told you to do. Okay, then accept the consequences and shut down any attempts, which you know, one occasionally gets for the, but you should do this because, you know, like, sort of expect people to sort of recognize. I think you can hold people into that place that they should be accepting through a variety of ways. But I think shame is a risky way to do it. Shaming people is really risky. Part about the sort of open and closed-mindedness. I mean, I think, and I didn't say much about this, but I think that part of what we think about, and actually Kant was kind of a proponent about this, and he said that that it's a duty to correct people's errors, and here he's thinking of errors like factual errors, but that you have to do so in a way that doesn't sort of diminish the person's respect for their own understanding. And he thinks that this requires trying to understand how whatever they're saying appears true to them. Like, why do they think this? Which is an exercise of the imagination, which sometimes we're not willing to do. Why does someone hold this view? We don't want to take this too far. I mean, you may just think, well, who cares why a white supremacist holds the view they do, like, in some sense, or maybe we do. But we, not in the sense that we're going to sort of accept everything, too, but as a way of trying to sort of see where is this person coming from that requires a kind of empathy. That even if it has some boundaries, not that we have to sort of accept it, but to see why is this person holding on to this. There's some lovely, so the couple of cases in the UK that have just arisen about the children and the life support. So this is the toddler who just died yesterday, and then before that the Charlie Gard case. you know, in looking at that, I think people will often see, like, so people, you know, you have what seems like different views about the facts of the case. You know, what is the extent of this devastation and all of this? So then I think we also see, but in some cases, right, we can see, imagine parents faced with this diagnosis too, right? We can accept that, like, let's suppose that there are parents who won't, and I think that Alfie's father may have been in this position of having beliefs that the medical state didn't support. But we can also look at that and say, well, of course, we can see that he's holding on to those beliefs because the alternative is accepting his child's terrible fate. And we can still think that he might be, as I'm inclined to think, that he's making a mistake about the facts, but a mistake that warrants tremendous sympathy from other people about, of course, right? Because this is holding on to hope in the face of tremendous grief, right? And alternatives that seem, you know, just unfathomable. And so we can kind of see why someone would hold on to what is in fact a false belief about a state of a child's possibilities because of the grief. And this isn't the right response to all of what happens too, but I think it's important when we see why people are like digging in their heels. Why does that matter to them? Yeah, that seems right to me. This is so. Where is the place where people? In Mexico, so that it's interesting because the places, I'm not sure where Mexico fits into this, the places where people stand the closest to each other or need sort of the least physical space tend to be countries in South America. I'm not sure so where the furthest, the U.S. is high on the list of distance. The only people who want more distance between other people than us are Australians. Australians occupy just don't get too close to an Australian in an elevator. But it's very interesting, like the ways in which interaction, the kinds of intimacy that strike me as related there and the kind of greetings that people expect. This is very specific in some ways to cultures and to places. And I think it's right, like some like not attending to someone or even eye contact carries very different meanings. It can be seen as disrespectful or it can be seen as to make eye contact or to not make eye contact in ways that are very culturally specific. And so that's another reason for sort of giving people a lot of the benefit of the doubt, especially in a very multicultural environment, knowing that these norms are shaped. Like this thing that I feel really strongly, I mean, we all know it's arbitrary how we behave in getting into elevators, but recognizing that what people are trying to communicate and what they are communicating are not the same. So the American on the elevator is not communicating rudeness by standing and looking at there. They're trying to express respect, right? But at the same time, it's going to come off as rude, and vice versa when someone says hi in an elevator. Somebody did this. A graduate student did a project where they went onto elevators in the U.S. and started, like, breaking the rules, like, facing the back or, like, talking to people, and everyone was like, okay, like, we need to get some help here. Like, something's gone wrong. And, you know, there's reason not to disrupt people as well, but also kind of an openness to, like, you know, like, people are meaning different things or doing things differently. Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, I'm a Midwesterner, and every time I still can't go to Manhattan, I still feel like, every time I step foot in Manhattan, I feel like a Midwesterner. I'm like, I know that these are just different conventions. I suspect we're losing a lot, partly because we're losing a lot of just plain out information, because we get a lot of information by looking at people's faces, because in general, human beings are extremely good at reading people's emotions off their faces in ways, even just with very limited information. So we're losing useful information about the person who is saying something on one thing, but we can look at them and see they're actually really upset. You know, we're good at this. And unless you're really good with emojis, you can't convey that very well in these other forms. But I do think the anonymity matters too, because it's much easier to sort of not see the person as, well, I mean, it's not being in relationship with them, to not just see the person on the other side as an actual person, but as, you know, the sort of either anonymous or sort of into the void. It does make a difference. Years ago, many, many years ago, the senator from my home state of Missouri, Jack Danforth, long retired now, had introduced a bill into Congress that didn't work, but it would be so interesting now, suggesting that the candidates, whenever they were making remarks in campaign ads, so they had to come out of their own mouths, like, so they had to be saying it, so there would be no third party, do you know what so-and-so has done, but that it had to be the candidate saying the thing about them, which would have really altered political discourse, wouldn't it, if everything that came out had to be said, maybe it wouldn't now, but this idea that when the words come out of your mouth and you're the one saying them, you own them in a way, whereas I think both the anonymity of the audience, but also when you sort of make a remark on a blog, and often if it's under pseudonyms or something, you don't feel like you have to own those remarks. They're not really yours. You're just sort of throwing them out into the void. It can be good, right? Because anonymous surveys, you find out a lot of stuff on college campuses with anonymous surveys that you would not if you if you ask them to put their names on them. I routinely ask my students anonymously to write down a piece of paper what is the best thing they've witnessed at Georgetown or experienced and what's the worst thing. And things come out that would never, first of all, they never raise their hands when I read them, like, and then I read them out loud. And so there's uses for anonymity that enable people to speak the truth that's important, but it can also go the other way. I mean, on the different sort of positions too, you know, and what we accept about people say, there's a lot of work in philosophy on something called epistemic injustice, which has a different kinds of forms. One of them is testimonial injustice, about how people's words are given different sort of credibility depending on who they are. So when someone says, this is my experience, and others like, nah, it didn't happen that way. That this is not evenly. Some people's words, some people's anger gets taken more seriously than others, and this is falls on predictable lines. And so thinking about how we accept what other people have said, what we believe and what we don't, takes a lot of thinking through.
Yeah, and I don't. So one thing that's also hard is in the context. So there's in a context where contempt is already taken to be the norm, which I think is a serious problem, and I also think it's worse for people who can't, or sort of who are more vulnerable to marginalization, which is one of the reasons that I think that even contempt in response to what is. Like, if somebody treats you contemptuously, sometimes the natural response is to respond contemptuously back. I think it has the moral problem that I discussed that, but I think it's also the wrong direction, because I think that the best way to sort of respond to contempt is to sort of maintain one's sort of standing and sort of keep outrage as opposed to falling into contempt as well. And I think, you know, it is interesting in watching, you know, sort of as political discourse has changed, as it clearly has, and what people count as acceptable and what people are like, no, this is not okay, and how people are willing to talk about this. One positive thing is that it's forced us into a kind of a recognition of stuff we may have taken for granted about certain kinds of norms. Now, it's possible for there to be norms of politeness that are disguising a lot of contemptuous behavior, so I don't think we want to sort of valorize, you know, like sort of... you know, there are ways in which you can be, like, really, I lived in the South long enough to know this, too. Like, there's ways of being, like, seemingly very polite on the surface, but in ways, there's a lot of stuff with tone of voice and all of that that can make something different. And, of course, you can have sort of a sense of decorum that still treats people really unequally. So I don't want to say, like, decorum is everything, but I think that we do see that there's ways in which one of the things that comes out that contempt actually degrades us all, not just like the person that it's aimed at, but all of us, because it lowers the level of discourse, right? That this is how we interact with each other, by tweeting insults back and forth to each other. Like, this is, you know, that this is sort of the model for interaction. And then one question is, well, is it possible to just sort of ignore what's going on and continue on? Maybe not. But I think one of the things that we can see perhaps now is what we've been taking for granted all along, and perhaps the significance of it. It'll be interesting to see whether we get a swing back the other direction and get a different kind of political discourse in the future, or whether it's gone very far past that way. I don't know. I think I was just joking is generally... Yeah, it's generally a problem. I think something is not true, but even some it's not an excuse, right? Because you're not always permitted to joke. I mean, so in some sense, like, there's some things that aren't joking matter. So it's like, oh, I was just joking. Like, meh. Like, even if you were just trying to joke, you shouldn't have been joking in this context. Like, it would be an inappropriate kind of joke. So I'm actually deeply skeptical of the, oh, someone is just joking. Well, don't joke in this context. Like, take it seriously would be this. Which isn't to say that we don't always want to let that go, but it is a kind of a context. Like, whether we believe someone that they were just joking depends on what we know about them and all of that. But I think it's usually a way of trying to sort of diminish responsibility by reshaping what one has said in a way that blocks off those responses. Oh, you can't be insulted. If I just said, oh, I was just joking, I didn't really mean it, then the person can't be like, yeah, well, it still was dehumanizing. Yeah. So I think it does make sense. I mean, I think, you know, there are many cases when what's going on behind anger is something else. I think it does depend on the content of people's fears. You know, there's fears, you know, there's lots of discussion, obviously, about what's caused the current political climate, too, but a way, the extent to which people, what are people's, you know, whether they're fears of, like, economic displacement or fears of a kind of social displacement. I mean, to some extent, there's some we don't want to give a lot of credence to. You know, if people are, what people are afraid of is losing an already privileged position. We want to be like,
You know, well, you didn't deserve it in the first place, so no. So, like, yeah, like, yes, you have to. Like, if you have what isn't rightfully yours, say a social position that enables you to occupy a place of superiority in ways that others don't, then for you to say, I don't have that anymore, well, you weren't entitled to it in the first place. I think we need to separate that from other kinds of fears, fears of loss of a community or culture that might be legitimate, but they can be phrased in ways that aren't, you know, I mean, this is interesting about obviously, Virginia, all these debates about statues, I think are actually a really interesting way of sort of, they're complicated and nuanced, as we know, because there's things that are really valuable there and things that are really important about what they express to other members of the community that are really hard to get by. But I think one of the ways to address that question, the anger, so what is it that people are afraid of losing? What do they want or not want with this statue? That's a helpful way of addressing some of those debates about statues. What are we losing? I mean, by sitting next to the man. Yeah.
We don't know, but either way, it's not too good.
Those, in a moment, right, this is where one wishes for that kind of mastery, like the total mastery of the situation. I mean, I think in these cases, the acknowledging of something's really sort of blatant, you know, the sort of, insofar as the comment is clearly dehumanizing to a member of the community, who's right there, in some sense. I mean, I'm inclined to think that that's got to, you know, involve some immediate, like, response in a way that affirms the value, the dignity of the person who's just been sort of declared not sort of, you know, the contempt, right, as a sort of blocking that, like sort of refusing. I mean, one of the things one of the interesting things that happened, actually, when then candidate Trump mocked Serge Kovalevsky, the New York Times reporter with a disability, is that this is a good sign about our study. It didn't go over. It didn't even go well with his supporters, right? Because people could see what they were doing. Like, no, like, that is not okay to do this. So the pushback against the behavior, and then actually he sort of responded by saying, well, I wasn't really doing that, which is, I think, not true. But the interesting, but the pushback from people across the political spectrum here was like, no, we're not okay with this kind of diminishing. I think that pushback can be done in ways that's respectful of both. And it could be, in this case, I can sort of on that, but I think the pushback is important as a kind of saying that it's not okay to treat someone else as contemptuously, but one can do it without being contemptuous in response, like trying to be like, you racist, even though she might be. But I'm not sure, like, exactly what to do in those cases is really, really difficult. As I was saying, I'm not kidding actually about the city. I mean, they're sort of like, okay, well, then I'll sit here and then talk, you know, engage with the person, you know, as well. I'm not sure what the right response would be. It's really hard. I spend the person's age, too, but...
Well, Karen, I want to thank you, and I know everybody here wants to thank you, and I hope you'll come back.
Thank you. It's been really fun. Thank you for all the questions. And
there is an article from Outlook that came out this week that's called Gospel Conversations, which I thought was particularly interesting, so I made copies, and they're over on the side. So grab one on your way out. Thank you again, Karen.
Thank you.